Hello and welcome to 50-50 Football. 50-50 Football is the only nationwide football show which speaks to supporters of the clubs about their team and gives you the insights as to what's happening at both ends of the table. We're looking to cover as many different sides as humanly possible, both inside the studio and over the phone. My name is Neil Atkinson, and some of you will recognise my voice from the Anfield Rap, but this doesn't focus on Liverpool, although we will look at Liverpool versus Arsenal this weekend as it's a massive game. Instead, we're going to be looking up and down the division. In front of me, I've got Sam Walkerdine, who's going to speak to us about Arsenal, Matt Jones to talk to us about Everton, Paul Dehaney to talk about Tottenham Hotspur, Rob Gutman's going to talk to me about Liverpool, but we're also going to get stuck into every side. And joining me on the phone as well, I've got Steve Goldsmith talking to me, Sunderland, and Bradley Hayden letting us know what's been happening at Watford. That's the way in which this sort of thing's going to work. It should have come out at 8 p.m. on a Thursday, and the review show, which will be done on a Monday once the weekend's games are completed, will be out at 4 p.m. From doing the Anfield Wrap, we've had some fantastic supporters who know what's happening at their club. This isn't a phone-in. It's something where we find the most interesting voices we can to talk to you, the listener, about what's happening at clubs up and down the country, to the entirety of the Premier League, is who we're looking to talk about week in, week out, because there's always such an exciting set of fixtures. So this weekend, we're going to start our conversation here. Everyone's going to get stuck in and have a little chat about Tottenham versus Everton. But before then, I want to relax into this conversation, and I actually want to talk about Danny Rose, and I want to talk about Jordan Henderson. And I want to say, you know, Paul Dehaney, that... do you think that there's a strange issue these days with the way in which football sides have gone, that in almost every side, there's like a first 11, every first 11 players become a key player? In the past, if your left back was out for a few weeks, well, you just sort of say, well, we'll get another left back and we'll be all right. Whereas now, because there's so many of these sides, they do so much stuff collectively as a team, that you lose one player and all of a sudden you can just lose the shape of an entire football team, certainly in the bigger, tougher, more intense games.
Yeah, I've got a theory behind that. I don't actually think that's the case. What I think happens is, for instance, in our situation, Danny Rose has been out and Ben Davies came in against Liverpool and got absolutely ripped to pieces by Mane. But since then, as games have gone by, he's steadily improved. And my theory is it's more about if teams are playing their first 11 all the time, if someone does get injured and someone's got to come in, they haven't played for, you know, half a dozen games themselves. So it takes them time to get up to speed. And then they get up to speed and then that said player who was injured comes back in, takes their place again. And then this kind of vicious circle happens. I think the only time it doesn't affect people is, like, I think probably United would probably be, would be the only team at the moment that I think are using their squad and rotating it quite regularly. And I think that's more than... out of necessity. I think if Mourinho was just playing one trophy, just going for the Premier League, for instance, I don't think he'd be afforded that luxury. I almost think it's pushed upon him.
Yeah, I totally agree. Having watched Liverpool this season, I think that syndrome you've described has killed us at times. We sat there at the beginning of the season in our good run, in the autumn, going, yeah, and wait till we have an injury. It's not going to matter because we've got the quality of Danny Sturridge and Origi and even Emre Can, who was a star of last season, not getting a game. Wait till they come in if we need them. And they come in and they're rusty as fuck. Mm-hmm. And you don't know. And it's exactly the syndrome you've described.
Yeah, I think it's funny you mention Manchester United there, because I think they play a style which is a lot different to Liverpool and Tottenham as well. I think when you're a team that presses really hard the pitch, every single player in that setup needs to be in tune with what they're doing. And I think going back to your initial point, Neil, I think when you've got one player who doesn't align with that and doesn't go where he's supposed to go and stay when he's supposed to stay, that can have a massive impact in terms of attacking and defensively as well. So I think it depends ultimately on the style. I think United are more of a sit back and contain team, and I think that's easy for players to come into and just, you know, find the position, wait and wait and wait. But I think Liverpool and Tottenham, it's a lot more difficult.
Do you mean like have a quiet 20 minutes almost?
Yeah,
you know what
exactly,
I mean? Let the game happen in front of you.
Yeah, whereas, you know, the two teams mentioned, they're a lot more chaotic and a lot more frantic in the way they go after the ball. And I think players need to be a lot more attuned to what the jobs are in those sort of setups.
A bit more choreographed, aren't they?
Yeah, that's good way to describe it, I think.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah, work with it.
Sam, from watching Arsenal this season and indeed watching everyone else, Arsenal had a sort of mentioned Manchester United there, mentioned Liverpool and Spurs. Arsenal are a bit more of a halfway house between both of these. In a couple of areas of the pitch, you feel as though players can switch in and out. But then, for instance, there's been massive issues that, again, Tottenham have had a full-back this season, you know, not getting a settled right-back, Bellerin's form being a bit in and out and having a couple of injuries. It's difficult, isn't it, to get these to get your players exactly where you want them for these managers at the minute?
Yeah, I think so. I think Arsenal have struggled at full-back quite a lot. I think last season, Monreal was great. this season. He hasn't really quite done it. Gibbs has come in and the same thing's kind of happened. He's not been quite up to speed, you know, and then when Gabriel has come in at right back to cover Bellerin, he's obviously not as quick as Bellerin, but he just hasn't quite done it. And getting that settled thing is they've struggled with that, especially without Cazorla as well in the middle, who seems to just settle everyone down and make them kind of relax and play their football. And he's a key miss, I think.
Okay, Tottenham versus Everton then first. And Tottenham first, amongst Tottenham versus Everton, last weekend against Stoke, Paul Tierney was a massive win in every sense.
It was. I mean, we got a bit of stick for the... a bit of unfair stick, really, for the European game, because I think we absolutely trounced that team we played. Ghent or Genk, one of the Ghents. One of the G teams from Belgium.
Unfortunately, one of them's going out next round.
So I thought we, you know, people talked about Wembley jinx, and even though we lost that game technically, we didn't lose on a night, but we lost over two legs. I wasn't too disheartened for two reasons. One is that, did I really want to play another 100 games to get to the semi-final and lose on away game on away goals? The answer to that is no. And the second thing was, I thought we finally kind of looked, in the game against Cisco as well, earlier on in the Champions League, finally looked like we've learnt how to play at Wembley. So that bodes well for the future. But
with this mad Spurs playing at Wembley next season thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's got, if we are going to be playing, I mean, I think the whole thing's bizarre. It's another story, we'll talk about it another time. You know, mainly because how are we going to have it as our home game and everybody else isn't? What happens in FA Cup games? We have an unfair advantage, etc., etc., etc. But going back to last week, Stoke home, we were outstanding. We were aggressive from start to finish. Well, really, we didn't have to be. We killed the game off by half time, really. Harry Kane, unerring finishes as usual. Just good from back to front. But really, I just like the aggression and the fact we were at it, and it's almost like, instead of freezing when people again might have been expecting us to slip up. I don't know why, actually. We've won, we've got the best home record in all four divisions, I believe, and won the last eight in a row in the league there. So conceded five all season, only two, three from open play, two penalties. So it's a fabulous home record. And now I said that, we're going to get smashed by Everton at the weekend, of course. But no.
I mean, one of the key things to take, you mentioned there, the quality of Kane, and that's... What, when you're mentioning this home record as well, the thing I've noticed this season is, watching Spurs from afar, is the ability to take the game away from an opposition side, especially at home. You know, White Hart Lane, you've seen the ability to turn 1-0 very, very quickly into 2-3, and the game against Stoke was a great example of that. There's, looking at Spurs, there appears to be no time Spurs are more dangerous than when they've just scored.
Yeah, it seems like we do go for the jugular. I mean, the game before Middlesbrough, even though we only won that 1-0, we absolutely murdered them, but... You know, that was one of those games that we could have easily conceded at the last minute and sort of dropped points because of not killing the team off. But in general, this season at home, we've been pretty strong. And, you know, Everton might be a different prospect or difficult prospect because obviously they're coming into this game on form. But I think the key to this one from our point of view is that the two centre-backs are fit, Alderweireld and Vertonghen. Not just because they're so important, but mainly because of who they're playing against. And Lukaku is a Belgian national. They play against him in training quite a lot. And I think I'm right in thinking that he's one of the only teams that Tottenham... Tottenham are the only team that he hasn't scored against, or one of
them. Is Adeviro going to be fit?
I haven't heard anything one way or the other. I'm sure Vertonghen will be, but I'm told that both of them went off for precautionary measures, and just because they've played three games in a week, we were 4-0 up, why risk them? But having said that, I was saying earlier, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if I, because I haven't heard anything, Pochettino comes out and says Alderweireld is out for the rest of the season.
Do you think Harry Kane's 45 last week gets lost a bit in terms of the hype it should have received in my opinion, given you know, the final followed it and Ibrahimovic's little personal show there? Because I thought what Harry Kane did in that 45 was one of the most devastating individual performances I've seen. It made me as a Liverpool fan think about Luis Suarez in a golden phase he had in coming into Christmas 2013-14, where he scored I think four against Norwich. He scored against Cardiff, scored worldies against Spurs. But Harry Kane was taking half chances there. You know, I don't know if Spurs fans, you take it for granted. Those first two finishes are quite stunning, to my mind. Okay, he's lucky with it, with the free kick, but then he makes the fourth with it, with an incredible touch around the side.
That's the part of his game that, you know, people don't, you know, probably respect as much as his actual build-up play and the stuff that he does. I think someone summed it up at the weekend where he's like a mix between Sheringham and Shearer. He can do both of those games. If he wants to come and play, come deep and receive the ball and set other people up, he can. But he can also play as that out-and-out number nine who's just going to score you goals, which is, you know, fantastic for us.
Yeah, it's so easy to be impressed by what he's been doing. And like you said there, Robert, it's the different types of goals he scores as well, isn't it? You know, on his left side, he's fantastic. On his right side, he's fantastic. Great in the air as well. And I think it's his physicality and the way he pins defenders and brings other players into the game. But it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on the change of system and how it's helped Tottenham. I think, especially at home, having those three centre-backs and having more players pushing on, it seems to just smother sides and suffocate them. And that's what happened to Stoke early in that game. They were just penned back for so, so long. Same happened to West Brom earlier in the season when Tottenham played them at home. They just couldn't get out. And those three centre-backs who were all so good on the ball, the two full-backs, obviously Danny Rose has been injured, but it seems to suit them being able to bomb on. And that system, I think, just suits every player in that Spurs setup, and it's taking them onto a new level, especially.
So right, because last season we had a lot of problems, and I think Pochettino's obviously seen this, where teams, you guys have had it as well, where they just come to White Hart Lane and just sit back, put 10 men behind the ball and literally just say, break us down. But with this system, there's almost like it's coming at you from all angles, so it's hard to really know how to stop it. So it's a really good point. I think the three, I like us because Vertonghen's such a ball-playing centre-back. You know, Alderweireld as well can ping balls left, right and centre. In fact, there's no one in that back five who can't play, you know, so it's not a case of, even though we've got five at the back, they sit. They all can bring the ball out, which causes all sorts of different problems.
Okay, there's this weekend then, it's, you know, question some sort of the converse point of view is, how can you be got at? I mean, that's the, because that White Hart Lane, it just hasn't happened very often. You saw at Anfield, I think there was an issue around, Liverpool were very, very intense around Dembele and Wanyama. They absolutely smothered Dembele and Wanyama and wouldn't let them play through that part of the pitch at all. And it's a difficult thing to do, but it's quite strange sometimes, isn't it, Paul, with sides, that sometimes the best way to actually get at them is the bit that everybody thinks is the strongest, because that leaves them, if that stops working, then everyone's wondering what's happening. Do you think that's something that Everton might look at, or do you think instead, you know, they might look to find another way around?
I think you've got to have, I think it was Jeff Cameron from Stoke said it last week. He came on a sub, but he'd observed most of the game, and I don't think he came on until they were 4-0 down. And he said, when you're playing Tottenham at home, your team has to have 11 players that are at it. You can't really get by on three or four. Mm. So, you know, you can't just get, you know, an Altovic, you know, not Charlie Adam, but, you know, another three players, you know, if they're all at it and the rest aren't, then what's the point, you know? And I think from Everton's point of view, they have to sort of take a leaf out of what Liverpool did when they visited the Lane earlier in the season, which was basically do that press and almost like unsettle Tottenham and make them play from the back, because that's invariably the mistakes and the goals that we've conceded this season come from us being pressured, making a mistake, kicking the ball out of play, and then the other team working from there and getting a goal, you know?
Well, this is what interests me about this game, and why I think it is the most interesting game of the weekend, and that Liverpool and Arsenal feel slightly a game between two sides who are rather battered and bruised at the minute, whereas it feels like a test match to me, this one, Matt, in that we're going to find out how good everyone is. Spurs this season haven't been great against other sides in the top six. They've had a couple of good wins, but they've also had a number of performances where they've been found wanting. On the other hand, Everton are in a good place, and it's almost it's this weekend that will almost answer the question, no matter almost how the league ends up finishing, whether or not Everton are a side who are genuinely trying to break into the top six, or a side who are going to end up finishing at the top of that mid-table sort of league, and that's why Spurs Everton is this interesting game, and it is this test for both sides.
Yeah, it's a massive test for Everton, and I think watching Tottenham last Sunday, usually I'd feel, you know, a bit of trepidation about going to White Hart Lane, but I think I was sitting there thinking, I think Everton are ready for this test now. I think they've had some really good performances at home, disposed of teams very comfortably, like Southampton, Manchester City, Bournemouth and Sunderland. they've gone away from home and got dragged into dogfights a little bit against Middlesbrough and Stoke. I don't think they're quite capable of negotiating those games properly yet, but I think they're ready to go to Tottenham and turn in a good performance. And it's interesting thinking back to the first game of the season, because obviously this weekend is reverse, isn't it, the first weekend. And Everton were really intense that day under Koeman. For the first hour, they were, you know, they kept Spurs at arm's length, but it was that last half an hour when Tottenham really got a grip of the game and could have gone out, probably should have gone out and won it, really. But I think Everton, from a physical point of view, I was reading a piece in the Echo today saying that Koeman now has got them running an average of 20 kilometres more a game than earlier in the campaign, so I think that's huge. So I think in terms of Everton, they need to go there and be brave, because it's great saying, you know, we're going to be happy with seventh, we're going to consolidate seventh, but say if Arsenal were to win in Anfield on Saturday evening and Everton to win against Spurs on Sunday, then the 6 points behind Spurs and the 2 points behind Liverpool, and suddenly that puts a completely different complex in the whole season. So I think Everton need to go there, be brave, like you said there. I think the best way to go is to try and get around Wanyama and Dembele. I think those three centre-backs are also composed on the ball. You'd be inclined to just let them have it a little bit, but as soon as it comes into midfield, that's when you're in and you snap and you stop them trying to play. But it's looking at the Tottenham team as a whole, it's very difficult to find weaknesses in there, and it's going to take a mammoth performance for Everton to get 3 points.
What's changed the last couple of months, apart from them just running more? Because I think we can always say that what they're running more. I mean, Schneiderlin's again looks like he's made a significant difference in there, in terms of composure, in terms of just knitting things up, and also in terms of just managing a game.
Yeah, well, I think the manager's got players who he wants. I think that's been a key part of it. And I think a lot of supporters were a little bit unhappy that, you know, Everton didn't go out and sign a striker or, you know, another wide player in the January window. But crucially, he's slimmed down the squad and he's got players who he wants and who know they've got a future there. I think Gerard Deulofeu, like Tom Cleverley, etc., all of the club and all, you know, could do a job as squad players. But ultimately, they knew the futures were gone elsewhere. Whereas now, I think you're seeing against Sunderland last week, there's a lot better morale in the group. There seems to be a lot more affinity between the players. And I think everyone's on the same page all of a sudden as well.
That's the young players coming in really helped as well. Yeah. Because that's one of the things I saw. Sometimes when you bring a couple of young players in, Holgate, Davis and Luckman haven't been purchased. But I think one of the things it does is it makes everyone think, you know what, this could not be more fun. This is more fun because these lads are here. That's what I've seen from watching Everton. You know, the sheer exuberance, especially of someone like Davis, even though he has had a couple of quietish or possibly even games airing on the side of poor recently, he's still snapping into stuff. He's still talking all the time. He's still just looks like a lad who's having a great time playing football, and that's got to sweep older players up in the enthusiasm.
Yeah, and Dave, I agree on Davis's performance has probably dropped a little bit, but you look at the game against Sunderland and he played a fantastic pass to cut the team open for that first goal, and he hit the post as well, so he could have easily come away from that match with a goal. He's a player who plays in bursts, but I remember early in the season when we spoke about this, about how the same players were getting the same chances at Everton, the likes of Morales, the likes of Deulofeu, Lennon, Cleverley. And the manager was giving them chance after chance after chance. And perhaps he was just giving them a go until January. And then he's got to January and thought, these lads aren't good enough. Out you go. And the younger lads have come in. And Everton under 23 is the top of the league in that division. They've been performing well all season. And it's good to see those lads who've been pushing in that team and performing well, and that team get a chance and take it. And I think David Unsworth deserves a lot of credit for that, because the likes of Holgate, Davis, Calvert-Lewin have all come into the team and they look like they're ready for Premier League football. They don't look like they're out of the depth. So really encouraging from that perspective, but it is going to be a completely different test on Sunday for those lads.
Last one before we talk about how we all see Sunday going, is Lukaku. The sheer quality of him, the sheer goal return of him is, you know, it's becoming absolutely evident now, I think, to all Evertonians that he's the best centre forward Everton have had in 20, 30 years.
Oh, without doubt, yeah. In terms of, I think there's been a lot of talk, a lot of focus about him this season, about what he can improve and where he can get better. But if you look at the things he does well, he does them so well. And I think his finishing this season especially, he's improved so much. I'm struggling to remember the last time he had a proper gilt-edged chance and he spurned it, or he didn't hit the target at least. That area of his game has got so much better. But I think these last 12 games of the season are massive for him, because in the past at Everton, he's faded badly in the second half of the season.
Really?
Yeah. In his first season, he struggled. I think from January onwards last season, he only scored 3 goals. So I think it's important for him to keep this up now and keep going. And while I do have a degree of sympathy for him, because he is the only real centre forward at the club, and he plays every game. He doesn't really get substituted very often. I think for him to maintain those levels and to go to White Hart Lane, to go to Anfield, to go to the Emirates Stadium, to go to Old Trafford and to perform and score in
them games. That's some serious run of away games you've got coming.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. but that's the thing, Neil. I think if Everton are to progress, they need to start looking at these games as opportunities to take points off their rivals and not say, we're going to go to places and contain. We're going to try and have a go at these sides.
From the outside, I mean, you know, okay, I'm a Liverpool fan, so I'd like Lukaku to fail. I can't stress that enough. But I'm also intrigued about him as a footballer and where his career goes. For years, it seemed as though he was, you know, there were a few interviews where he disrespected Everton as a concept, quite frankly. But he seems more settled now at the club. But what do you think him and his agent are saying behind the scenes? Where do they see him in 2 or 3 years' time? Do they think he can build a massive career at Everton? Or is there another type of Euro super giant that he could look to?
I think it's clear that he wants to move on.
But who's he suited to? Because I think he's an unusual player.
That's the point I was going to make. It's a really difficult one because he's a wonderful footballer, a wonderful goal scorer. But if you look at what's needed to lead the line for those, you know, enormous clubs in Europe. You know, you think of players like Lewandowski, Suarez, Benzema, Higuain. I think they've got that extra bit to the game, haven't they? I think that, you know, in terms of the work rate and the technical ability and the hold-up play, they've got a massive edge on him. And I don't think Lukaku's ever going to get that. So it's a really interesting one. I think Chelsea's probably the one that's mentioned the most, isn't it? But he's not a replacement for Diego Costa, I'd say. There's a lot of misconceptions about his game, I think.
I think that definitely working with Omri has improved him.
Yeah.
And how can that not, you know, particularly on if you were talking earlier about his finishing improving, yeah. And, you know, I'm sure that Omri will take, well, he probably won't take any credit for it, but I'm sure he's got something to do with it. And I think he's in that great position at the moment where, has he signed a contract or he's about to sign a contract?
He just said it's 99.9%.
Right, so he'll sign a contract and he's kind of in a no-lose situation because he can stay at Everton and see how it pans out for the next sort of 18 months. If he sees that they're making significant progress forward, he might want to stay.
Yeah.
But if he isn't, I'm sure he's got some sort of agreement or he'll have some sort of clause in that contract that means, you know, if a certain team offers a certain amount of money, then he can move on. So I'm sure at this moment it's not, I don't think you're going to get to the summer and all of a sudden there's going to be will he stay or will he go kind of thing. I think you're going to get at least another 18 months out of him, I would have thought.
Yeah, I would be surprised if the club sold him in the summer, because I think it is really important. I think last summer was one of transition in terms of implementing a new model, getting a new manager in. I think this summer's the one where Everton are going to try and really look to make a statement in that sense, in terms of the recruitment and hopefully in terms of the players that they get tied down, because Ross Barkley's only got 18 months left on his deal as well. Need to get him a new contract. And I think Lukaku's the one, though, isn't he? He's the player you'd think, if Everton get him tied down, while it won't guarantee he's going to stay at the club for, you know, another 5 years, it's a positive message to
and
send
it encourages
out.
Other people to,
yeah,
sign
absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely, you know. Yeah.
It's also what Rob was saying before as well. For him, it might be better to do almost, you know, to have that conversation of one more year at Everton, become more well-rounded and be able to go, right, this is almost pick his own club as to where he's going to go next. I always think it's quite, you tend to see the absolute tip-top centre-forwards choose the club that they're at. For instance, we've talked about Kane before. You know, Kane very clearly has chosen to be at Spurs,
yeah,
if you know what I mean. Like, you know, there's no getting away from that. When Rob referenced Suarez before, Suarez chose to be at Barcelona. Yeah. I think that, you know, that's where you end up. So it might be that if he wants to be able to have his pick, the idea he does a full season and one more full season at Everton, bangs in 30 and looks like an all-round footballer, can only help him. And if he's got good players around him to do that, that can only help. How do you see it going, Sunday?
I struggle to see weaknesses in the Tottenham team, like I said earlier. And I think Everton will go there. I think they'll play three at the back. I imagine Mason Holgate will come into the side. Koeman will look to be a little bit more cautious. I think it might be a draw. I think Everton will be under pressure early on. It's just whether they can get through that initial really aggressive phase from Spurs, because I think in the last few home games they have showed that they come out the traps firing. So I think a 1-1 draw.
Rob, what are you thinking looking at it from afar?
Yeah, I can't see past a draw. They're two teams. I wouldn't say Spurs aren't exactly bang in form, but their last outing, and it was at White Hart Lane, they were as bang in form gets. And Everton. I don't think Everton are going to go there and just get beaten. I think it's a statement game. I think Everton will be so solid, so focused, that they won't allow themselves to be beaten. I find it hard to see Spurs getting defeated on their own ground. That's why I can't see past a draw. So, yeah, let's say 1-1.
It's a statement game, Sam. I quite like that as a description. Maybe they should have that across all the Sky coverage of it. It's a statement game. It is a statement game, isn't it, really? But if either side manages to take 3 points, they're going to feel absolutely enormous bouncing into the following week.
Yeah, I think they will. My prediction, for what it's worth, I'm going 4-2 Spurs.
Oh, this guy.
4-2 Spurs. I think goals galore, frankly. I can imagine Kane scoring. I can imagine Lukaku scoring. So I'm going 4-2.
4-2.
Well, I'm definitely watching it now.
Yeah, you've sold
tune
it.
In.
Yeah. Tune in for the Sam Walker down 4-2. Be disappointed if we don't get it.
Sky box office. Yeah.
Paul, how do you see it going? I mean, firstly, how do you see the game sort of playing out before just the idea of a prediction?
I do think it's going to be one of those where we're going to have to really battle for it. And if we come out with the same mentality that we did against Stoke and we have our two key centre-backs fit, I think we'll win this one 2-0.
2-0. Ooh, getting the clean sheet in there. Not quite as exciting as Sam's game. I'd rather watch this than yours.
Positive Dehaney makes me very afraid.
Says a lot about the journey that Spurs are on. Earlier today, I had a chat to Steve Goldsmith about Sunderland, and they entertained Manchester City at the weekend, and the vibe around what's going on at the bottom, because trust me, Steve, as much as anyone ever can, knows the terrain.
Delighted to be joined by the host of the Wise Men Say and Into the Light podcast, Wise Men Say, out on a Monday, Into the Light out on a Thursday evening. Steve Goldsmith to talk to us about Sunderland. And I'm going to be brutally honest with you, Steve. I'm not going to stand on ceremony. A league table's a meritocracy, and I'm sort of the view that currently Sunderland look a bit like the 20th best side in it. Is that me being very, very mean, or is that the way in which it's feeling up there as well?
I think it is right on form, but there are factors to take into it. I think the injury situation has been horrendous, and fans of every club, of course, have their own sob story, don't they, when it comes to injuries and stuff like that. But some of the guys being missing for us, Lee Catamore, Jan Kirchhoff, are right out the middle of the park and right in the engine room, and yeah, even some of the players he's brought in, Paddy McNair's out for the season. Duncan Watmore, who give us a lot on one flank, is out for the season. Anicha B, who brought a lot of the team, is out. So I would be fair to say on that, I think, you know, if it wasn't for that injury situation, I think things would be differently. What I will say is that I have, in the last 4 years, seen worse Sunderland sides than this, cut further adrift than this at this point in the season.
Well, firstly, when I say I think Sunderland look to me the poorest side, that's partially in the context of the fact that I don't think from 20th to 14th at the moment, I think you can throw a bit of a blanket on them. It doesn't take much to suddenly look like the 16th best side, does it? And I think that's what you're driving at there, that it's not going to be that hard for Sunderland to make a couple of improvements and look back in the fold of what's going on down there. And also, there's only 3 points from 20th to 17th.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think something that a lot of Sunderland fans are clinging on to is the fact that we've been so bad, and somehow we are only like 3 or 4 points away. But I just don't know how that is, to be honest. And the positive, you know, the encouragement that gives you is that the sides above you mustn't be all that. If they aren't good enough to pull away from a side who, let's not forget, we give the whole division a 10-game head start, and it was the worst start made by any Premier League side ever, which takes some doing. And the fact that we've recovered to the point where suddenly we're looking and we're saying, can we get some of these injuries back in the next few weeks? Kirchhoff and Catamol, obviously the big ones, and Anicha B. Pickford's just come back from injury as well. So if you get those three guys into the team, you know, we've seen us put these runs together before. The running we have doesn't look as scary as the ones that other teams have as well. I think we have a couple of rearranged games, which help, because we have Middlesbrough and Arsenal are still in the FA Cup. So those weekend games are gone, which means they will now be midweek.
Presuming Arsenal beat Lincoln, which is not an unreasonable presumption.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Sorry for the presumption there. But let's say that Arsenal would scrape through that one. You look at the two weekend games gone, and I think that would help. I know that, you know, I've spoken to you on other platforms before, and I've mentioned that progression isn't great when you seem to be relying on somebody like Lee Catamore to come back into your team. That just sums up how bad recruitment's been, I think. But his inclusion would make such a massive difference. I mean, when Sunderland lost 4-0 to Southampton the other week, they were the better team by far, first half. Southampton scored two quick goals. I have to say, and I said at the time, this was before we saw Gabbiadini in the cup final, I said at the time, I thought both goals, I didn't think we did a lot wrong. I thought his movement was excellent for both, and we just got caught with two sucker punches. But it was the mentality that went down, and somebody like Lee Cattermole wouldn't let that happen. He wouldn't let the standards drop. And when we were on top for 20 minutes and couldn't find a way through, standards started to slip a little bit, as if they were getting frustrated. And he doesn't let that happen. He drives the team on. So, clutching at straws, perhaps. What I would say as well, if this is a question that you had lined up for me, it's the most relaxed I've ever felt about the prospect of getting relegated, to be honest. Well, I used to work with a guy, right, and he subscribed to this theory all the time that it would be good for Sunderland, go down, clear the decks, refresh, come back up, and I never, ever went along with that. You look at some of the sides down there, like Sheffield Wednesday, Leeds, different scenarios that have contributed to it, of course. But you look at some of these sides, you know, nobody's got a right to come back up. It's a tough league. And you could quite easily go the other way. I would rather stay up and hope that a couple of signings can catapult you away, because as we've just discussed, the standard isn't that great. And we're only a couple of players away from probably being 8 points better off than we are. So, however, this season, I do feel more relaxed about it, in that I think some of the young players we have would be absolutely fine at that level. I think the likes of McNair, Watmore, even Anichebe and Dong in midfield, all young players, and I think they would be fine at that level. I also think we would get a big transfer fee for Jordan Pickford if we were to go down, and we would get a big-ish transfer fee for Cornier if we were to go down. On top of the parachute payments, with those young lads, you know, and potentially 30 million quid to spend on it, I would say with David Moyes as well, I wouldn't have a problem with Moyes at that level. I think he would be steady enough not to take us the other way. And for the first time in years, you know, that's the case. Because previously we haven't had some of these young players around. And you just think, right, we're going to have a mass exodus here. And I don't think that will be the case this year.
Is there also something in, I don't want to really dwell on this too much, but is there also something in sort of getting these young lads used to winning games of football? Because I think this is one of the, when I look up and down the division at the minute, Palace got themselves a massive win last weekend. But some of the sides at the bottom, and, you know, the side that I watch, Liverpool, have managed to develop their own very special case of the yips. But, you manage to sort of get yourself into a position where you just get too used to the lads you're playing next to being at the scene of the crime when you don't win another game, if you see me point. And, you know, I think Middlesbrough are struggling from it a bit at the minute. That last season, you know, we keep it tight at the back and we snatch something and we go from there, and it works for us. And now they're looking at it, they're looking around at each other, played 26 and only 4 wins on the board. And suddenly that's 22 times this season where you've played a game of football and not won. And I think that's something which is tough for footballers, and, you know, it might be good for Sunderland as an entire team, as a club, even as a city, to sort of get used to going to football matches on a Saturday and coming out with the other side of it with 3 points.
Yeah, more northern teams to play as well. Shorter journey for us. look, we've got history in this division now. How much do you take history into things? You know, is it relevant or is it not relevant?
Yeah.
Because people keep saying to us that we should know our players in the Premier League, and you should be grateful for this and grateful for that. I know that when Steve Bruce was here and we had higher ambitions than finishing 10th because we had a better team, and that he underperformed with that team. And we were told to remember who we were by a lot of neutrals, even though we've been about 10 years in the Premier League consecutively now. However, at the Championship, right, here's for a stat. Now, you know, football goes further back than the Premier League. Of course it does. But if you use that as a reference point, the first time Peter Reid took Sunderland to the Premier League in 1996, we have only been in the second tier for 4 seasons.
Wow.
We've won the league twice and we finished third twice. So as far as that division goes, we are heavyweights. So if we've been told to remember our place in the Premier League, then surely we go there. Does that count for anything? You know, if we start winning games, it has an effect, because the fans will get behind it. If they win games of football, the fans will turn up. They turn up now and we're losing every week, and there's 40,000 there every week. So if we start winning games of football, will build momentum, and suddenly, you know, that little bit of the little bit of swagger might return, because our record in that division since the first time we got the Premier League speaks for itself, really.
Looking at what's currently going on, then there's the obvious and huge reliance on Defoe to stick it in the back of the net. There's been the odd big win. There's a really good point against Spurs, the excellent win at Palace. This weekend with Man City to come, it doesn't feel like, you know, Man City look like they're picking up a fair bit of form, showing a lot of quality, showing good at putting sides to the sword all of a sudden. But there is the idea that Sunderland could mount a rear guard action, and it sort of makes the mind up, I suppose, in that, you know, when Southampton come, there's the thing in the back of Sunderland supporters' minds thinking we could really do with getting 3 points from this, whereas any point that you get from Man City on Sunday will be seen as a good point.
Yes, I almost feel like it's a game we need for that reason, Neil. We played Burnley at home after that, but, you know, historically Sunderland would beat Man City and then they'd lose to Burnley, who haven't won away from home all season. That's what Sunderland do normally. I'm actually glad the games are this way around, because, like you say, nobody's expecting us to win, but I do kind of feel like the players need a game where they're going to have to say, right, we could get embarrassed here if we don't all muck in, look out for each other and try and win our battles. I think that's the kind of game Sunderland needs, personally. I think if it was a home game against a mid-table side or against a Burnley or somebody like that, I would worry about them not turning up again. I would worry about the response the crowd might have. Once some of the passes start going astray and they concede a silly goal. So if we lose to Man City, then we'll be written off even more than we already are. That could take a bit of pressure off them. We almost need this kind of game, I feel. Let's just see what happens. We used to have a good record here against Man City, but that's gone in the last few years, unfortunately. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I have to say the fans are a little bit split at the moment. I'm very much speaking on behalf of myself and the lads I do my shows with. There are other blogs and there are other sort of podcasts, and if you listen to them, they are very down and anti-Moyes at the moment. So I'm probably putting a calm persona across. Other Sunderland fans aren't feeling like that at the moment, I have to say.
Is there, just to begin sort of round it off, firstly, is there a figure in your mind in terms of, this is the interesting thing for me about the situation at the bottom, is there a figure in your mind in terms of how many points you think you'll need, or even how many wins from this position? Because I can't even imagine, you know, looking at it as a distanced observer from the outside, I think it's, even now it's difficult to sort of say, is it 34, is it 36, could it end up being 38? I don't quite see how we can get to 38.
What happens, Neil, this is, like I said, this is the 10th season.
You know the terrain. I'm asking you because you know the terrain.
exactly, and that's what I was going to get to, because I'm saying this is the 10th season we've been in consecutively in this spell in the Premier League, and the last four, we've really struggled. People forget that a little bit. We've never been, you know, heavyweights or anything, but this is the fourth season in a row we've really struggled. And so because of that, we always have a show and a podcast where we'll sit and say, let's have a bit of fun and let's work out how many points we're going to get, and let's work out how many points the teams around us are going to get, and we get guests of those clubs on, and we all come up with a prediction. Now, we're never anywhere near. What we see is every year we seem to look and say, oh, this could be the lowest yet. 34 points might keep you up. And then you always need 38 or 39. That's just what happens, because clubs towards the end of the season put an unlikely run together.
Yeah.
And they start winning games you don't expect them to win. The 2014 one for us, you know, was mad when that happened. When we won at Old Trafford, we won at Stamford Bridge. We drew at Man City. They're 7 points you don't expect to get straight away. So it does happen. And I am a little bit maybe deluded, but confident that we are capable of putting a string of...
Well, you've got a goal scorer. You've got a goal scorer, and that's the thing that I look at when I'm looking at, for instance, I'm looking at Middlesbrough at the moment, who look... wins from 26.
Yeah, I worry for Borough.
Hull haven't got a goal scorer. There's all the talk that they're playing nice stuff, but they haven't got somebody kicking it in the goal.
And Hull, yes, they've improved. The new managers have pressed people and stuff, but I kind of think, I feel like they're playing at the limit. If you can't finish above Burren Hull, then you deserve to go down, with respect. I'm sure they'll say exactly the same about us.
Okay. Always great to speak to you, Steve. Say again, Wise Men Say podcast comes out on a Monday and Into the Light out on Thursday evenings to find out what Sunderland are up to. Weekend game, let me put you on the spot for a score prediction very, very quickly, but it's going to be a test.
Yeah, I think we'll draw. I think we'll get a point. 1-1.
1-1. Good confidence from Steve. Let's go back and see what everybody else thinks.
It's become another relegation weekend where everyone needs a win, which is all of them now. There's a bottom seven, and Steve there is talking about Sunderland. They've got Manchester City, so they can't really expect to get one, though, you know, his prediction of a point is nice and generous, Matt. But, you know, you're looking right the way through all of this. Bournemouth going to Manchester United doesn't look great. Leicester versus Hull. Stoke have got Middlesbrough at home, so Middlesbrough themselves, you know, only four wins all season. Swansea-Burnley's huge. It could be by the time Swansea kick off against Burnley, they'll know that a win puts them above Manchester United. Palace going to West Brom, and as I said before, Sunderland versus Manchester City, they are your seven sides really. And you can throw a blanket over them. I think that of the seven, Sunderland and Middlesbrough look the poorest at the moment, but it wouldn't take much to suddenly accelerate up and look like you can get out of it.
No, watching Sunderland last week against Everton, they were particularly poor, and you know, you expect a David Moyes team to be aggressive and organised, but they were pretty poor in all aspects of the play. They lacked a lot of fitness as well. They struggled late in the game. So I think they're definitely going to go. The thing about Borough as well, only four wins all season, but only 19 goals scored. And I think it's really difficult to see.
From 26 games down, 19 goals in 26 games.
That's remarkable. And I think he doesn't strike me as a character, Karanka, that you'd need in this sort of situation. I was watching his press conference earlier today. He's very dour, very downbeat. And you're thinking, in that kind of situation, this kind of battle, you need a galvanising figure, somebody who's going to inspire the players. And he doesn't look to be that. Obviously, he's had his run-ins there in the past. You just wonder whether he's fully behind it anymore. He doesn't seem to look like he is from the outset. But I think the one to watch is definitely Bournemouth. They're in such poor form. And since that game against Arsenal, where they were 3-0 up and got pegged back to 3-3, they just dropped off a little bit of a cliff.
But they could be the big losers this weekend, couldn't they? Everyone else looking at that bottom cluster can go, not exactly, none of them go, I fancy us, but they can all go, we can, and this would be such
it's
a
tough
big...
for Sunderland as well.
Yeah, it is tough, but at least they can say they're at home. At least they could just about visualise getting a point. You know, I think Bournemouth are going to Man U, and there's just no chance for them. I mean, I'd love to be tempting fate so that something happened, but I'm not going to be. But this feels like the cluster of teams. It almost is going to be a when the music stops kind of scenario, and I like these kind of relegation battle seasons.
Are they your favourite ones?
Yeah,
as a man who's seen a few.
Yeah, as a Liverpool supporter, I've never been involved in one. I actually would like to. I'd like to actually sit down with a pint with a fan of one of these teams who's done it a lot and go, is there a point at which it gets enjoyable? Obviously, the first half of the season, it's shit because you're losing and you're losing and you're losing. But in that final third, you know, we're looking at going, oh, we're going to finish in the top four. Yeah, maybe we are, but we probably won't, and we'll finish fifth or sixth. But they're going, and they can have like a cup final in the last three games when they get out of jail. I actually wonder, do these guys enjoy it? One day we'll ask one of these guys question.
Well, we'll do it next week if you want. I'll get someone on, and they'll get stuck in, and we can find out. Sam, firstly, would you enjoy it? But also, secondly, it's for instance, I think that Swansea have had a lovely 2017, and they're having a great time. They've got Burnley this weekend, and what they've got, which they've got in common with Sunderland to a certain extent. We'll come back to Leicester in a minute because they're a bit different, but they've got lads who stick the ball in the back of the net. And when you talking about Middlesbrough, and when you're worrying about them and talking about Hull, sticking the ball in the back of the net is having someone or one or two lads who you're able to look at and think, well, he's got a goal in him. That helps you get out.
Yeah, I think Lloriente, is that how you say it?
Lloriente.
I thought he seems to be a nice kind of focal point for Swansea. They seem to be finding him and he's scoring. I remember when he joined a kind of, because I remember Arsenal were linked with him for years, and I was really intrigued to see what he would be like, and it's nice to see him.
He looks fabulous as well. I mean, he's a beautiful header of a ball with that mane of hair.
Yeah, but in terms of that, just to go back to what you were saying, Rob, about enjoying relegation, one of my favourite things is match of the day on the last game of the season when they jump around different relegations.
Yeah, and you're just glad it's not you.
Yeah. But surely, if you're involved with that, if you're watching one game and there's another little screen with another, oh my god,
that's
got to be fun. That's got to be fun.
I think as long as you get out of it,
that'll be the worst.
As long as you get,
I actually think, you know, the sickness we go through, like, you know, trying to qualify for the top four, you know, and every game seems like it's a cup final. I think it must be like that, but the opposite in the sense of it's just pure pain and trepidation. In fact, I think I'll probably be ill. Like if I went into the last three games of the season knowing, you know, we had to win two to stay up or even one, you know, I'd be seriously ill.
Do you know what? Ring it in sick to jobs.
Yeah. Do you know, maybe it's because I'm perennially glasses half full, but in that moment, you know, when you've finally gone down and the camera pans to all those people with their head in their hands, like this is like literally they're about to die. It's the worst thing that's ever happened. There's a part of me that'd be going, all those new championship grounds next season. Yeah. What an adventure that! Because you know, in another way, I've seen those years where we fucked up getting in the Champions League and we're in the Europa League, and everyone's going, "Oh, what a nightmare the Europa League will be." That'll be a little nice Bulgarian away there. You know, that's not the end of the world.
I was thinking about Alexis Sanchez because he came on Sutton United, and everyone's like, "Oh, why did he play him?" And I wondered whether Alexis was like, well, this is a fun ground to play at. Can I have a go?
Yeah, no, the idea that he's gone, he's knocking around and training, he's gone, I want to play in that.
Yeah.
Don't be messing me about. I want to have a game there.
Yeah, if I was playing in the Serie A and they had a weird away at Tiny Ground, I'd love it. I'd love to have a game.
Back to Leicester then. They turned it on against Liverpool on Monday night, Martin. Again, when we're talking about having goals to get you out, it wasn't just goals, I thought, that what you saw on Monday night. And they'd done it early in the season against Manchester City, so you can't get carried away. But the extent to which they suddenly looked like, of those seven sides, the one who just should not be there at all. And you do still expect, for all the talk that they overperformed to get first, they're so far off where they should be in terms of the fact that they're in this little scrap. You've got to presume they're going to cruise back up into the 11th or 12th here.
Yeah, although I think this will be a completely different test for them, and I think Liverpool really played into the hands in the way they went about that game on Monday night and allowed space for Vardy to run into and just gave them a platform and gave them confidence early on to go on and get the 3 points. But yeah, I think as well what he did on Monday, he went back to that formula which worked so well last season, didn't he? Okazaki's a player who's not prolific, he doesn't catch the eye very often, but he's effective and he does a good job and he's a really good foil for Vardy, and he's been on the periphery this season, hasn't he? Ranieri tried to move away from him, so I think this will be a completely different test, though. Hull have been impressive under Silver, haven't they? Gone to some good places. They went to, obviously, Old Trafford, played pretty well. Went to Chelsea, played pretty well. So I think they'll go there.
They haven't been putting the points on. Like, I think we've all been saying they've been playing pretty well because they beat Liverpool, and so I was watching them do that. But also, I saw the games they had against Manchester United. They haven't been, they're still in there, you know what I mean? And again, I think they're another one who was suffering from the fact that if they had Jermaine Defoe up front, they'd probably be on 28 points by now. But they haven't got Jermaine Defoe up front. They've got and Mbakani, yeah. and you know, he hasn't scored a goal for them yet since he's been there.
It's difficult to say with them, but they have got talented players, I think, in the final third. I think Markovic has been in and out for them, hasn't he? He's done okay. The lad Evandro as well, they've gone in, looked a decent player when I've seen him. But I can see Leicester maybe just slipping up a little bit in this one and potentially drawing here, but Hull will be able to react after that game against Burnley. Was it because he did pretty late goal, didn't he? Was it Michael Keane scored late on? So I think they'll be on it in this one. I think this one could be a draw.
Okay, then. I spoke to cover the mid-table aspect of the Premier League this weekend. I spoke to Bradley Hayden about Watford and Southampton's quintessentially mid-table clash. Joined now by Bradley Hayden, watfordblog.com and Watford FC blog, to talk to us about what's happening at Watford at the moment. And what's happening at Watford, to be honest with you, Bradley, is the job's getting done. Points are being picked up quite quietly. They're just efficiently going about the business, Watford, which, you know, doesn't often make for an exciting story, but it's worthy of mention and worthy of credit.
Definitely, yeah. I think in the last month, we've definitely picked up a little, and we're unbeaten in five of our last six, which is good going. Over Christmas, we had a bit of a dodgy period with a disappointing few results. Part of that was down to injuries. Part of that was down to poor form. But in the summer, in the January rather, we brought in Tom Cleverley, Mbai Niang, and Mauro Zarate, and they've all come in and made a big impact. And it's no surprise to see that we're starting to pick up a few more results because of that. We got a few draws against Middlesbrough and Bournemouth, and then the standout result probably in the last few weeks has been our victory over Arsenal, really, which no one was expecting, and we went there and caused an upset and got a good result. So Last month, it's definitely been a good upturn of results. We've got a few wins, a few draws, and only a defeat to Manchester United, but we did ourselves no harm whatsoever. So it's been a reasonably good month, and we're pretty much on the road to getting safe and beating a last season's 13th place finish and points target, which I think most Watford fans would have certainly taken at the start of the season.
It's you mentioned the new players who've come in there, the new lads who've been signed. There's, you know, it looks like they have made a difference, and they made a difference in terms of just giving the whole club a boost. I think from the outside looking in, it feels like those lads have, you know, they're coming in with different names. I mean, Cleverley's been a player who's had quite an odd career now when you look at it from a distance, but you know, there's been a lot of heat around the other two, Zarate and Ambiang, that they're known as talented footballers, and the shame now is that Zarate's got his cruciate ligament injury, really, because he was a player that everyone was enjoying watching.
Definitely. I mean, against West Ham at the weekend, Zarate was the best player on the pitch in the first half, and he was really causing problems, and he'd made a good impact in his first few games. It's a big blow to lose him for the rest of the season, because the part of the reason he was signed was to fill the void left by Roberto Pereira, who got a serious injury in December and will miss the rest of the season. And it's just typical that the player we've signed to effectively replace him, within a few games he's picked up a serious injury, and he's also going to be out for the rest of the season. So it's a shame about that, but hopefully we'll be able to continue to pick up points as the season goes on. Niang is a very talented player. He's still very raw, but he's got a lot of talent, and he was brilliant against Arsenal and Burnley. But I think if you ask any Watford fan, probably the pick of our January signings was Cleverley, because he's come in and he's been absolutely magnificent in the park. He's exactly what we needed. We need a little bit of bite in midfield, and he's been putting in some really, really good performances, putting in his body on his line when need be, and he's also capable of keeping the ball. He keeps the ball very well. He can spring a good pass, and he's also prepared to get forward as well. And it's good that he knew the club, having had a loan spell with us in the past, and that's definitely helped him hit the ground running. And he's been a real star for us since signing. And I think if you ask any Watford fan, we've all got our fingers crossed that we take up the option to sign him permanently at the end of the season. Same with Niang as well. So the January recruitment, was definitely very good. And Niang, they've all made an impact, and it's just a shame that Zarate will miss the rest of the season now. But fingers crossed we can keep going as we've been doing the past month or so.
In terms of sort of the next three, because that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on. You were mentioning the points finish. You're mentioning the sort of ensuring that you get safe. Every aspect, really, at the minute. You know, in terms of where you finished last season, it's three very winnable games across March. If we include the 1st of April, it's, you know, Southampton at home, Crystal Palace away, and Sunderland at home, and they are three quite sort of, you know, the real opportunities. Get 7 out of 9 there, and it's all but guarantees Premier League football next season, and it all but acts as a springboard to ensure you end up with a solid 45 points plus finish at the end of the season.
Definitely. I mean, the next few games is definitely an opportunity for us to take points. They're all sides in around them and below us in the table. So and with two of them at home and a decent and away match against Crystal Palace, I mean, we have to be looking to get a couple of wins from that. Probably the biggest question mark with Watford this season has been consistency, because you never really know what Watford side will turn up. Is it going to be the side that beat Manchester United in September and beat Arsenal in January, or is it going to be the side that went and lost 6-1 to Liverpool back in November? So there's still a bit of a question mark over consistency, but it's, considering the position we're in at the minute, certainly in the past month or so we've become a bit more consistent, a bit more difficult to beat. And that's something we need to take into the rest of the season, and hopefully we can pick up. I'd say we need to be targeting at least 2 wins from the next few games. I think on paper you'd probably say our best chances of doing that are against Palace and Sunderland, really. I think this weekend Southampton are going to be difficult test. They proved they can cause any team problems on their day against United last week. And Gabby Adini, who they've got up front, looks a real good player. So it's going to be a tough match this weekend, but I'm confident that we can at least get a couple of wins from the next three games, which hopefully enable us to push on for the rest of the season and start building for next.
Who stood out then, other than obviously focusing on the new players who've come in? You know, the manager's chopped and changed his shape throughout the course of the season, and with one eye on that Southampton game, as you say, who do you feel as though stood out?
For Watford recently, there's been a couple there. At the back, Yunis Kabul, since the turn of the year, he's been absolutely immense. He's been so solid at the back. And I think that is partly down to the manager, Walter Mazzari, going to four at the back now. He looks a lot more comfortable as part of a back four, and he's put in some really, really good performances since the turn of the year. He was brilliant against Arsenal. He did really well at the weekend against West Ham, and he's definitely looked a lot better than he was in part of a back three. And I don't know whether that's down to maybe the first few months. It took him a while to settle in and get in the feel of the club and whatever. But since the turn of the year, he's been very good. Another one who stood out for us has been Troy Deeney. I mean, up till December, since he's got his 100th goal out off his back, he's looked more potent. And I think changing again to four at the back and changing formation certainly helped, because he's got more support up front with him now. He's got Niang one side of him. He said to Zarate, he's a cleverly, he's a Kapoor pushing forward. Whilst when we've been playing three at the back, he wasn't necessarily getting that support from the midfield. And he's definitely benefited from the manager changing formation, and we look a lot better playing with a back four, and it's more a 4-3-2-1 or a 4-3-3 we've been playing with, and we've looked a lot better. So since the turn of the year, aside from the new signings, Kabul and Deeney have stood out for me.
And expecting more of the same this weekend then against Southampton, who are going to be slightly shell-shocked after losing that final. But now, you know, they will be able to focus on the league campaign going forward. So that's a positive for them. But you would hope that, you know, it's a game which feels as though it should be, you know, they're 1 point behind you in the league. Yes, they've got a game in hand, but it's a very winnable game.
Definitely a very winnable game. I mean, we went down and we drew with them on the first day of the season, which was a good start to the season. And the last few weeks we have picked up results and shown that we can beat teams around us. I mean, I think probably one of the biggest gripes from the game at the weekend against West Ham was instead of looking to build on our 1-0 lead, we sat back a bit too much and let West Ham come at us, and that inevitably led to them drawing level. And we only really started playing after they got back on level terms. So I think the key for us is our main strength is to keep attacking, because we're not necessarily got the personnel in our squad to be able to sit back and retain a lead in the last few minutes, especially if it's only a one goal margin. So I think the key for us is to keep attacking, even if we've got a 1-0 lead or 2-0 lead, just keep going, keep playing our game, and using the pace of Niang and the figurehead that is Troy Deeney up front, and playing to their strength is going to be the key for us. And getting Niang in the game as well, because when we've got him involved and he's running at fullbacks, he can cause teams lots of problems. So I think it's definitely a winnable game this weekend. We can't take Southampton lightly. We've got to perform well, because they'll obviously want to be coming to this match looking to bounce back from a defeat against United in the cup final last weekend. So we need to perform, but I think if we play well, we've got a good chance of getting 3 points, and fingers crossed we can do that.
Okay, back over to everybody else, but that is Bradley Hayden from WatfordBlog.com and at WatfordFCBlog on the Twitter. Always great to get him on, and let's have a little chat about those games, but also then move on to talk about Liverpool versus Arsenal.
There is nothing more mid-table than Watford versus Southampton this season, but in many senses it's interesting shifting from the relegated side to, as you say, Rob, you know, you do wonder whether or not you want those cup finals to those sides where it becomes almost a quiet procession towards getting to 43, 44, 45 points, which I expect both Watford and Southampton to do. Both good sides. Southampton have at least had a laugh this season, made a cup final, and Watford are happy enough, I think, at the moment to be getting regular 12th place finishes in the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, it's what their managers say to motivate at this stage. For Watford, I think he's going to be saying every week, just get one more win, and we don't have to be the team that worries about relegation. You know, we saw the example of Bournemouth. Don't be those guys. If you're Southampton, okay, they've come out of a really sort of dramatic period, getting to that final and coming so close in that final. Do they see themselves as having one big push on them to edge into the Europa spot? Are they putting down a marker? It's unlikely, obviously. Or are they putting down a marker for places for next season and pushing on? I mean, quite frankly, I mean, I sat there watching Southampton from a Liverpool point of view in that final last weekend and thinking, you know, because they are the club we shop at. I would have three or four of them.
You probably will.
But you know what? There might be one or two other clubs in the Liverpool and Spurs, actually, area of world football wealth who are thinking, you know, Romelu could do a job for us. Bertrand isn't the worst left back in the world. Van Dijk, as we didn't play last week, was to come back in. That's, I think, the challenge ever so
remarkably predatory, this talk.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm looking to next season already.
Remarkably
Southampton predatory. Bring it upon themselves. I mean, at what point are they going to turn round and say to their fans, look, you know, we're building something here. We're going to start to keep these players and make our club compete. I mean, how long can you go just being a feeder club? And, you know, no disrespect, they were great at Wembley. How great would they have been with half a dozen of the players? You know, just half of them, had they kept them, how great would they be now? You know?
The nature of football, Matt.
Yeah, it is, but at some point it's got to stop. It's not like Southampton are a team who are, you know, short on money, struggling at the bottom of the Premier League. You know, they've made that step now where they're perennially in the top 10. Now, surely from the fans' point of view, I was listening to a Southampton fan after the cup final. He was almost in tears because he was saying, you know, yeah, we're brilliant in that, but, you know, someone's going to come and take Gabbiadini. I don't even want to get his shirt with my name on the back because I know that somebody's going to come and take him. He's only been there 5 minutes.
Put a big X on your shirt.
But Southampton are, you know, West Brom wouldn't sell us Berahino for like 2 years, you know, and that's West Brom, and we was offering him 20 million. So don't tell me that Southampton are, you know, a bigger club. They're at least on par with West Brom.
They do continue to make progress, though, don't they? I think if you look at, you know, in the league this year, they haven't necessarily, you know, they've had a new manager come in. They did lose some really important players, but they made progress in the 2 years under Koeman. Higher points total, higher finish. This year they've got to a cup final as well. So the model does seem to still be working, doesn't it? And they were very, very close to capping that by winning the trophy.
But if you think about it, they did it with Pochettino and they did it with Koeman. They got to this level and they've settled in this level. And if you're a fan, you eventually go, are we happy with this level, with this sort of ebb and flow between, what is it, 14th and 7th? Mm. Or is there a push on? It's interesting, like, I remember seeing a stat, was it last season, or the end of last season, Leicester are the 19th richest club in world football. Mm-hmm. So Southampton, possibly the 18th or the 21st. They're not, we tend to paint them as these minnows. But
the issue is that's comparisons, isn't it? Because so many of those clubs are in English football in the top 20. And yeah. So you end up in this loop where there's the pressures. It's back to the very fact that because five of the top 10 richest clubs are English clubs. So that what that means is that there's obviously a massive gulf between that top 10 and if you're in 18th, 19th place in terms of being able to throw your weight around a bit.
Yes, but they're also in the richest league. And that my key point is, yeah, okay, they're not going to readily finish ahead of some of those wealthy clubs, as you say, in the world football ranking. But instead of sort of having an Adam Lallana or a Romelu or maybe 30, 40 grand a week, who then move to Liverpool and get 90 grand a week, they could say, you know what, three of these lads we're going to target with their wages. We're going to pay them 120 grand a week so that Liverpool have to think about whether they want to bid for
it. I almost get the impression that they're quite proud of what they're doing, in the sense of they're developing these players and then waving them off and say, good luck in the new world. You know, that's all very well, but if I was a Southampton supporter, with Tottenham, it happened with us, didn't it, where we were selling our best players up until Gareth Bale. As soon as a Spurs player became big, you just knew he was off. You know, whether it be Berbatov, going back Carrick, Sol Campbell, blah, 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 blah. It doesn't happen anymore. It's like, let's develop our own players and develop them for our team. You know, Southampton have got a brilliant academy, but you've got to remember they've got a massive catchment area. They've got Pompey to compete with, you know, who are kind of nowhere at the moment. So therefore, all those young players in that area will go to that famed academy. It'll get better and better. You know, try and make that next step up and build. I don't want them to, actually, because they'd be really good, and that means that we might drop down. So actually, stay where you are.
Yeah, but behave yourselves. All right, last game we're going to talk about is Liverpool versus Arsenal. Home side first, massive game. It was a devastating defeat against Leicester, Rob. There's a strange vibe around Liverpool at the moment, and I don't think we're quite going to be able to work out exactly what the vibe is around Liverpool until possibly until mid-April, possibly until the whole season's finished.
Yeah, but it's beginning to finish very, very quickly. The end is coming into view. It feels a bit like it's a classic Liverpool peter out season, which I think one in two seem to go like that for the last endless period of time. What's devastating about it is, and devastating is the word I have to use, is we were taken so high in the autumn and into December. It looked like a Liverpool team that could achieve things. It looked better than the sum of its parts. It was without stars, but what it could achieve as a collective was frightening at times. It's still today, you know, before coming into the Arsenal game, stands as the team top of the league when the top six play each other. And that's not just a team that gets up for it on the big days. We've seen Liverpool sides over the last couple of decades who get up for the odd big game and Anfield gets behind them and they've got a win against champions Man U under the belt. This is different. We're able to reach high levels consistently, but we're also able to reach low levels consistently. And where it goes from here, I don't know. There's enough Liverpool fans complacently saying this week, oh, just like us to go and beat Arsenal. I'm not taking that for granted. Arsenal are far too good. And I worry that if we lose or draw with Arsenal, that the season becomes one where we end up in around the sixth, even, God forbid, seventh position, and the Klopp project looks in a difficult place.
My thing on that, Rob, is to have the conversation around the fact that we started the show discussing this idea that everyone's got to be fit. And this is where I think this Liverpool side has struggled, is that when you're building a football team when everyone's got to be fit for it to function, Liverpool seem to be in this really strange position, which there shouldn't be, and on paper there sort of isn't. As much as I like Jordan Henderson as a footballer, there shouldn't necessarily be Jordan Henderson doesn't play, oh no, it's all going to go to bits because Emre Can can't do this long list of things. You know, it's a football team that's turned itself into this mad balancing act where it needs so many of these lads to be available and selected to be able to genuinely play at the level they want.
It does feel like that, and I'm not sure. We talked about this at the top of the show, didn't we, with Spurs, about whether it's a factor that the second string or the immediate deputies are just not up to. I feel for Liverpool, it's been the problem. I don't think it is. I'm going to agree with Paul at the beginning. I don't think it is that fine calibration. I think the immediate deputies, for whatever reason, and we could debate in each individual case extensively, have fallen off a cliff. I'll focus on the strikers because at the end of the day, attacking players can define your team, I think, in football. Liverpool had this incredible front three. They all scored goals. Liverpool were the top scorers. Mane, Firmino, Coutinho. Put them on the pitch. Everything else behind them should function. Well, the minute we took one or two of those out of the equation, Daniel Sturridge was up there 18 months ago with certainly the level Harry Kane is, Aguero is. We had reached such a level where we could have him as a backup. We could indulge his injury periods. But when he's come back in now, he's not been the same player. He's not been a third of the same player. Divock Origi, who was fantastic in the run-in towards the Europa Cup final last season, not being the same player. And I think those are two massive misses because Liverpool have got nothing off the bench when the goals aren't flowing. And that's it, more than the fine calibration for me, Neil.
But then you've said there, for instance, why have they fallen off a cliff? I mean, that's the next question, and where sort of the conversation around the manager himself begins to have a few questions sort of asked. Why have they fallen off a cliff quite as profoundly as they have? Because that's what I find difficult watching, is that those are lads, for instance, Origi last season, you cited there. He's great in the last half of the season. He's terrific. Earlier this season when we play Spurs at home in the League Cup, he has 15 minutes where no one on the pitch can live with him. They can't get near him. And now you're looking at it and it is, even when he went through a little purple patch, you're thinking, well, he wasn't playing that well. His all-round game wasn't what you wanted it to be by any stretch of the imagination.
It's really hard. Because Sturridge,
you can say, well, it's injuries and he needs a run of games and all the obvious things that 27-year-old pros who've got a record of an injury-splattered career can say. You can, honestly, that's dead easy in that whether you agree with it or not, you can at least go away some easy sentences. But then you're looking at Origi and you can say, well, you know, young players don't always develop on a straight line, but this is dropped off a cliff territory.
It is. I felt coming out of the summer transfer window for Liverpool that we were one attacking player light. And the reasons I cited then were exactly as you said about Sturridge. Danny Sturridge, fantastic if he's on his day. We can't rely on him because of the injury record. Ings, who was our fourth choice at that point, also had an ACL injury, which is repeated. Can't rely on him. But I also thought the evidence on Divock Origi wasn't strong enough to be able to say he can be our second, he can be our first call on reserve attacking player, because it was only his first season at Liverpool last season, and I think he arrives in the August as a 19-year-old. He looks very raw, and he finds it hard to contribute in the first half of last season. And then he has that purple patch over a 10-game spell. I felt at the start of the season that Origi is it's just the nature of his style. He is raw, and this was entirely predictable. In a way, if you ask me to point a finger, I'd look at the transfer committee, Klopp, the management. I think we were attacking player light.
We've got ourselves into a state against the poorer sides as well, but that's not this weekend. On the getting into a state against the poorer sides, it does feel as though they're all sort of looking at each other, and that at some point solutions are needed, as though, you know, someone's got to do something, maybe that says to the players, this is the way home, this is the path for Liverpool. But that's not this weekend, which is the strange thing. Normally, off the back of the bad result, you go, well, you know what, it's time to make sort of unbelievable changes, it's time to be dramatic. Whereas the only real question for Liverpool this season is whether or not they can get Lovren back fit in at centre-half and get Henderson back fit in at centre midfield.
Yes, I think so. There's a formula against the bigger sides, and the bigger sides aren't going to sit deep. Against I don't think it's necessarily about tactics against the smaller sides, it's about mentality, because we've seen Liverpool frustrated by low blockers like Hull, and it looks like Liverpool don't have the guile to get behind those sort of teams. But then a team that play a high line like Leicester find a way of outplaying Liverpool, quite frankly. So it seems to be, it's the antithesis of Klopp's proclamation that the way he beat teams in bigger sides than Dortmund in Germany was to drag them down to their level. Well, Liverpool are a side that get dragged down to a level, or play fantastically well against the big sides. For me, the benchmark, if Klopp wants to put a training video on how to play against a lesser team, put Spurs Stoke on from last week, because what I realised in that one is when a team low blocks you, they don't stand on the edge of their own 6-yard box. They stand on the edge of their own penalty area or penalty spot. Find a way to get them 5-10 yards back, so they're so deep that they have no way out. That's what Spurs did to Stoke last week. Big side, different proposition. But it does put the pressure on Liverpool to be so up for it. If 11 men aren't going to be at 100% on Saturday, we aren't going to be at Arsenal.
This is the Henderson question, I think, as well. You know, sort of looking a bit rudderless in his absence against Leicester. And that's been the case all season. But he played, the manager made a couple of noises earlier this week that, you know, it might be hard for him to make it, Rob. But he played against United when the expectation was that he wouldn't. They just found a way to get him on the field, and then he hobbled off at the end. Didn't look 100% the week after either. You know, it didn't look like he was on a curve there. It wouldn't surprise me if Liverpool are doing absolutely everything they can to get him on the pitch against Arsenal.
Yes, I think that's possibly true. I fear that if he does get on the pitch against Arsenal, it might be his last contribution of the season, because I think at some point someone's going to say Henderson needs some rest. I mean, he's had a variety of heel injuries, plantar fasciitis, which I spoke to a doctor friend the other week. This is not inside information, but he said to me, I said, well, how serious is that? He went, it's not a complex one, it just needs rest. So, but we're not giving Henderson rest, and we can't afford to give him rest. But I wonder, in the wake of a bad result against Arsenal, where I think Liverpool go, Jesus, our ambitions are severely limited now this season, we can't ruin this player's career. I wish I could have something positive to say.
It's a bruised foot. They're not saying it's the same thing again. It's a bruised foot. I mean, unless you're sort of saying, I suspect it is the same.
Have you not seen any, I'm not trying to spread rumours here, but I did sort of see something going around that he had a broken bone in his foot.
There was talk of that, but
has that been shot down?
Yeah, it was shot down, yeah. It
feels like things are being played down a bit. I mean, Klopp was asked by a journalist, I think at the beginning of the week, post-Leicester, is it a long term with Henderson? And he started getting a bit existential about it. He goes, what is long term? Is it this or is it that? You know, and I thought, that doesn't read like it's nothing to me.
It must be strange from the outside, really, having lived in Liverpool, Matt, you know, that the Jordan Henderson conversation's been an ongoing conversation for effectively almost since he signed. And yet, you know, you saw on Monday night Liverpool looking rudderless without him.
Yeah, and I think Charn is a player who, while I think he gets a bit of unfair stick at times, he's somebody, I've said before, he seems to cherish every single little touch of the ball. And I think in the way that Liverpool play, you need someone in there who moves it a lot quicker. I think Henderson's done that pretty well this season, hasn't he? But the reaction to that loss, I think, has maybe been a little bit overblown. I think if you look at the table, Liverpool are 4 points off second place in the Premier League. And I think overall, I think you'd all would have said, you know, that's decent at the start of the season. And I just wonder whether, you know, thinking back to when Everton were in a similar run when they before Christmas, when it was one win in 10 games, we talked about the same players getting the same chances. Maybe it's time for a Klopp to change the system a little bit. You know, you mentioned your midfield problems there. You've got a very capable centre midfield player playing at left back. You know, maybe James Miller comes to that position, do a decent job in there against Arsenal. Moreno, you know, he's not really been given a chance since the season.
Well, the one that wouldn't surprise me for him to do would possibly be if he feels the Henderson thing isn't just 1 week or 2 weeks, maybe drop Wijnaldum even further back and put Wijnaldum at the base of the midfield, and then maybe look at either pushing Milner into midfield and having him do a bit of the box to box work, or you know, look to find someone else to do that. Maybe even drop Coutinho back in, do something which takes that pressure off Chan, who I think. I thought he was all right second half against Leicester, but I think he got to the point where the question isn't around his attitude. The question's just around what you're saying about touch, him worrying about it and not wanting to make a mistake.
Yeah, I think the other thing as well was if Liverpool found themselves in that position earlier in the season, they'd scored a goal, was it 65th minute, something like that?
Yeah.
I think that would have, the momentum would have coursed through the team, then he would have gone on, and you know, That kind of aggression and intensity wasn't there, was it? Leicester were quite comfortable in the latter stages of the game then. There wasn't really any sustained momentum or any pressure. So I think it's clear the intensity has dropped off, but I think Klopp may look at it and think maybe go to three at the back like he did in the second half, which looked a little bit better in stopping the counter-attack. Look at different things, maybe bring in a young player and just try and kindle something.
Yeah, I'd definitely look at a change of system. You know, just have a look at something. I do really think.
But you wouldn't do it against Arsenal, would you? If you're the Liverpool manager and you've seen your results against the top sides this season and your performances, it does feel massive to think, will we do it against Arsenal?
I just think that Arsenal are the sort of team that if they do catch fire, they will play on those weaknesses of having, you know. I think that square pegs and round holes works to a certain extent, but eventually it's almost like we're always saying about a young player coming in. You know, he'll have that six games where he plays really well, but once he acclimatises and the novelty wears off, you have a period of a bit more indifferent performances before it turns round again. And I think that, you know, I've never been happy with your keeper situation.
Maybe brother testify.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a question I was going to ask you guys today. Would you take, I know there's a connection here, a horrible connection, but would you take Kasper Schmeichel as your goalkeeper? Even though the Man United...
No, not even for that reason.
You just don't rate him?
I just think he's all right. Like, he could come in and struggle. He could come in and do all right. He could come in and do quite well. I think it's really hard buying a goalkeeper if you're Liverpool at the moment. I don't think it's... Because I think that you've got... Everyone's all right, if you know what I mean. Apart from those who are really, really good.
Okay. Well, back to the matter in hand. I just feel like if you're playing Milner there and you're playing Lucas at centre-back, it's almost like against Arsenal, that might be a little bit...
But you just said that against Tottenham, that might be a little bit. And then we got, you know, and this is why it's hard for Liverpool manager.
But I mean, even before Christmas with the Milner situation, not one person. If anything, we were doing the opposite thing and praising Milner at how good he was playing.
Yeah,
because he wasn't just defending; he was creating goals as well from that position. But you know, has it gone too far now? I just think, and also what you were saying before about have we gone over the top? Look. Nobody, you know, you've got to take this into context that it was the new manager bounce thing. You know, you've really got to look at the fact that Leicester had to come up with some sort of performance there. And you have really caught them at a bad time. And it does look bad. But it will only look better if you get a result this weekend.
This weekend then Arsenal. And Arsenal are interesting side for Liverpool to play Sam at the moment. So few wins at top six grounds away from home since 2012. And the Wenger talk isn't going anywhere. And if he doesn't get a win this weekend, and then there's the second leg against Munich, it's gonna continue really. And it's such a difficult situation, isn't it?
It is. It's funny because I was thinking about
how do you feel about it personally?
Well, I feel emotionally torn about Arsene Wenger. I think, and I was thinking about what questions you might ask me about Arsenal. And weirdly, it feels like everything is going back to that. Oh, you haven't won against, you know, top teams. What's happening with transfers? Well, you know, it all feels like it's just feeding back to this question about Wenger. And I genuinely feel really weird about it, I think. I really, really like Arsene Wenger. I feel like I would invite him to my mum's house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there aren't very many kind of football players or whatever, I would...
Would you have him as godfather to your child?
Exactly,
then?
I would.
Of course you would.
And I would. I think that's what's that's why there's so much kind of conflict within Arsenal fans, you know, fighting on the terraces, for goodness sake, you know, about it, is that he's just... He represents so much, so many good times and so many great memories. And he has created something really amazing at Arsenal. But it's just got kind of stale, I guess. I was listening to something the other day and someone was saying about what would happen if someone came in and we didn't do as well. We ended up finishing 8th or 12th or whatever. And someone said, yeah, but at least it's different. And that's kind of quite an odd, like, I'm not quite sure how I'd feel about that, you know. And
I reckon that person definitely voted for Brexit.
but I can understand what they're trying to get at. It's the feeling of it just happening again and again, which is so frustrating. And obviously, the beginning of every season is great for every team because you're so excited about what could happen, you know. And so you do each time, you think, well, you know, maybe this is the year when the money from the stadium means we can do this, or maybe we will do a nice Champions League run, which I thought this year.
So did I, to be fair.
And then here we are again.
It's the... I think he's had a couple of little issues. I feel a bit sorry for him with the Cazorla situation this season. I think that's really impacted on so much, because so much of what Arsenal do well through midfield has gone through Cazorla, and he's ended up in this weird little situation where he doesn't obviously like... I'm prepared to almost say that if Arsene Wenger was here now and I could make him speak honestly, I suspect he doesn't like any of his centre midfielders. Like, he just doesn't like them. They're just not very him, whereas Cazorla is sort of quite him, you know, but... It is going to... I think almost the problem he has now is that it's so... that Arsenal have in general, that it is just such... It's the defining, overwhelming question.
Yeah.
When is he going to go? How is he going to go? How is he going to manage that? How are Arsenal going to manage that? What is the thing that happens next? And then every single player, and I mean every single player at Arsenal, from the very best ones like Sanchez, right the way through to the ones like Jenkinson, it throws like a light on every single player in terms of their own career. If he was to go, or if Arsenal were to choose to get rid of him, or however you phrase the language of this, it would be such an earth-shattering moment, and no one knows what's the other side.
Exactly. And, you know, there's also kind of there's a lot that he does at Arsenal, I think, that people are quite worried about. Like, so it's not just so much, who will come in when he eventually goes. It's actually, he's so ingrained with every kind of detail of running the club that there's actually so much more planning to go into him leaving than
it's
just like
three people. It's like you'd have to get three people at minimum.
I used to work at Arsenal, and I'll tell you a quick story that when I was working at the museum, there was a floodlight. There's floodlights all the way around the outside of the stadium which illuminate the kind of artwork they've got around. But there was one bit of the stadium which didn't have a floodlight, which was a little bit dark. And so the guy from the museum said to his boss, why don't we get a floodlight put up there? And he was like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. Didn't say anything else. 6 months later, he came back to him and he said, I've had a word with Mr. Wenger, and he said the floodlight's a good idea.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
And exactly. And I was like, that is insane. Why is he worrying about that kind of thing?
Unless there's a Brian Wenger who's got just accidentally the same name.
So, I mean...
Head of maintenance. Yeah. Bri, they call him. Yeah.
But I did wonder whether, you know, maybe an answer to it was... Because they were talking, the people talking about, should he just move upstairs? You know, should you bring in a director of football? All this kind of thing. Maybe Wenger should move upstairs and concentrate on the floodlight situation. And then we have a head coach. You know what I mean? And then you can kind of have a hard transition.
Or director of football, where he's in charge of everything football, but not the actual team, you know, structuring the youth teams and stuff like that. I mean, my own personal view with Wenger is that he should really be the one to be big enough and turn around and say, you know, I think I've done my time now. I've done a great job. I don't think he's that big a character that I think it would be embarrassing for all concerned if he gets sacked.
Yeah.
And the fans just protest.
But
so
don't you
much.
Think he just enjoys it, Paul? I mean, that's my thing. My thing on this is that I literally think he enjoys being Arsenal manager. I think that's almost the problem.
But there's a time,
I think it's like he's probably thinking, well, what would I do with me
like,
days?
Like chance.
That's fair enough. Then go on and manage another club. But you know, I think sometimes you outstay your welcome, and you've got to almost like being at a party sometimes, and you can see you've been there too long. Everyone wants to get rid. You know, and you won't leave. You just got to take that it guy. Upon yourself and get off, you know. And
well, I've heard people say that maybe the final great thing he does for Arsenal is to say bye.
Dignified, man. You know, I think that's a dignified way for all.
Jesus, it's ironic. He's the most dignified human being there's ever been in football, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm far from an Arsenal fan as a Liverpool fan. I think the idea of some sort of step away, and not even just a ceremonial step backwards, isn't a bad idea. Him as director of football, he appoints his own successor. He stays there as sage counsel. He looks at the overall transfer thing. He keeps his eye on the floodlights. To me, that is, you know, we've had debates in the last couple of weeks about Ranieri and whether, you know, just for decency's sake he should have stayed on. The guy wins one trophy. You know, Wenger has been Arsenal, and it's not like he's taken them to the edge of relegation here. He keeps them as a viable force in European football, and you know, there but for the grace of getting Bayern Munich drawn every year, he might have got to another semi or another final. I, you know what, he wins the league that ends at fourth every year. It's no bad achievement.
No.
But I do get the instinct that says, what if? What if there's a higher level for Arsenal? And maybe the right thing is that he steps back.
Well, I feel like Arsenal are on this weird line where he's kind of consistently on the weird line, which is doing enough to keep people happy that he should stay, but not doing enough that people are also annoyed. Do you know what I mean? So there's that's why definitely. It's so difficult, because, you know, so I heard someone saying the other day, and they were saying to me, oh, yeah, you shouldn't be too annoyed because, you know, you're, whatever it was at the time, third in the league. You're in the quarterfinals, probably the semifinals of the FA Cup. We're in the last 16 of the Champions League. We're probably going to go out. But, and it's like, that's the thing. And it's like, yeah, that's...
He's like a good Donald Trump, isn't he?
I just don't think... It's interesting you said that he enjoys managing Arsenal. I just don't really get that vibe from him anymore. I think after that Bayern game in particular, he looked so downbeat and distraught after that. And even in his press conferences since, he's not really had that same kind of brightness about him that you usually see from Wenger. And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned the level of involvement there. That's unsustainable in modern football. It simply can't be done. There'll be no other manager at no other league club in the world who has that level of involvement. And the longer that goes on and on and on, the harder it's going to be for Arsenal to move away from that.
Matt, on that, and I agree that he hasn't quite had the same shine. And I think the Bayern, I think defeat will have hurt, you know, to an unbelievable degree. But that's almost like just completely focus on the human element for a minute. Then, you know, you're a man of his age, you've got this involvement at this club up to and including these floodlights, this mad thing, and then the idea that you go from that to playing a bit of golf, you know what I mean? Like, I understand that he might not be enjoying it as much as he might like, but imagine that what would look like if you're him, the abyss, you know what I mean? This vacuum of nothing.
There's like a safety blanket for him.
You know, I think we all go through it at some point, but you know, it is quite a stark human tale in a sense. The idea that he's, you know, he's absolutely the bedrock of something, he's the age that he is, there isn't really the opportunity to go and do that anywhere else. And whilst the sums of money involved are absolutely unbelievable, and he should be able to think, you know what, I can have a nice 20 years of life off the back of this, you know, the idea that he gets to June the 30th, it's his last day in the office, and he's got what have you got planned for tomorrow, Arsene? Oh, I was just gonna do the garden. You know, it just doesn't feel like it. I mean, that must terrify him. I think.
Well, he said he's going to be managing next season, hasn't he? Regardless of whether he stays at Arsenal or not, I just wonder whether he might fancy a year at Barcelona.
I heard about that today, actually. I heard a rumour saying, oh, he might go to Barcelona. And weirdly, when I heard it, I felt kind of a bit calmer. I was like, well, good. As long as he's okay, then I'm okay. Are you all right? Awesome. It's like, are you okay, Grandad? You know what I mean?
That's the problem. Okay, I mean, Koscielny, Ramsey and Giroud are all expected to be available for selection. Whether or not they get selected will be interesting. It's tough for Arsenal to change approach, Sam, again. In the same way, it's tough for every side to change approach, I think. I think you either choose to be a side that plays a certain way, which I think both Liverpool, Arsenal and Tottenham all are, or you choose to be a side that feels as though it can chop and change for every occasion. Man United, Everton, to a certain extent this season. Arsenal fall into the former category, so it isn't really... They can play a little deeper, they can look to soak up a little bit more pressure against Liverpool, but they can't really look to do 10 men behind the ball and just spring.
No, and I think that, again... Going back to Wenger, that perhaps is a
as you always have to,
because it's that when it doesn't work, it's that inability to kind of to switch it up. When you see teams go playing against Liverpool, and they seem to like some of the teams seem to have kind of figured out a way that works quite well. Why don't we just do that? And it's okay to
don't do that.
That. You know, I think that's kind of frustrating. I know that. Wenger doesn't give too much kind of instruction on the day. He just kind of, he has an overview of what he needs to do, and then he trusts the skill of his players to do what they have to do. You know, I've got another story, actually, if you want one. When it was a game against Liverpool, actually, at the Emirates, a few years ago, and it was Lee Dixon told the story, and he said at halftime, he didn't say anything. They were losing 1-0. And he didn't say anything at all. He just left the players to do whatever they do, listen to music or just sit quietly or whatever. And then just before they went back out to play, he said, play it more to the left. That was it. And they did. So he obviously saw a little weakness somewhere in, I can't remember what year it was. And, you know, perhaps they played it more to Marc Overmars or to Robert Pires or whatever. And they won.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that kind of like, you know,
day gone? Because my thing for Wenger, my most probably biggest criticism of him in the last sort of 18 months has been like, it's almost as if Arsenal were like, right, go out there and play, lads. You know, if it goes well,
exactly,
then all fine. But if it doesn't, it's like, you know, the famous there is no plan B. I mean, I wouldn't say that, I'd just say there's one way of playing. And if you stop that, I mean, we've been saying that about our own teams, I would say there's more ways to skin the cat with us. But with Arsenal, it's literally, I don't see those tweaks anymore.
No,
do you know what I mean? I don't see that adjustment when you're 2-0 down to bring a game back. I just see if you're 2-0 down, it's going to be a collapse, or the team you're playing is probably pretty weak, and they're going to collapse because they're not good enough. You know, I hope I'm not being too harsh on him, but
I think there's a weird, this probably sounds a bit silly as well, but I think because there's so much pressure on him, because a lot of like current managers seem to do a lot of running around, Klopp, Conte, lots of jumping in the crowd and stuff. Now people are kind of, you know, why is Wenger just sitting on his seat? Why isn't he rushing up the down?
When he sure gets complimented for that.
What's more rock and roll than that?
He took the opportunity to push Anthony Taylor, which is an opportunity we'd all love to take. I'm not quite sure. I mean, this is the interesting thing, actually, Rob, which is I think both Paul and Sam are alluding to. I'm not quite sure what the way home for Arsenal is, other than play better than Liverpool. And that's not to say that won't happen. There's every chance that Arsenal actually play better than Liverpool, but you'd like to think there's another sentence beyond play better than Liverpool, whereas maybe it starts Giroud, maybe it's go a bit more direct, that can work, maybe it's whip the ball in a little bit from wide areas, look at set pieces without necessarily sort of changing the way they play, maybe that is the next sentence. But it is quite difficult to sort of write your five sentences of things Arsenal can do, but bar sentence one, which is just play better than Liverpool.
Well, if I'm doing my Arsene Wenger, Sam, and I just say one thing, it's just be calm. And I've watched Arsenal come to Anfield in periods where they've done well for, like, I remember a decade where they always seemed to get a win at Anfield. And we'd arrive with our huff and our puff and our crowd and our tempo. And Arsenal would stay cool. They might even go a goal down. And then there would be these triangles played around us and Vieira would be clean through. I remember one quintessential goal. And I think if Arsenal come to Anfield and just stay calm, they know exactly what Liverpool are going to do. And most teams just flake out in that atmosphere and in that Liverpool intensity, especially against this modern Liverpool. I think Arsenal just stay compact, stay calm and wait.
Massive.
And blow us out.
Yeah, I think this is the perfect game for Liverpool to bounce back, to be honest. I think if Klopp could pick any team in the league to play in Anfield, it might well have been Arsenal, just the way they opened up the game, the lack of intensity having in the central midfield positions. I think he will see this as a really good opportunity to bounce back, and I think Liverpool will win.
Think Liverpool will win, Paul?
This guy.
I think that it's going to be ballet attire, and it's going to be 2-2.
Okay.
Did you get that? Ballet? 2-2?
No. Ah, 2-2 is
smart. Oh, nice, nice, nice.
Sam?
It's better than Desmond's.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going for a 1-1, a cagey 1-1.
Cagey 1-1?
Yeah, I don't know why. I'm just trying to make myself feel better.
Caginess. Rob Gutman.
Jeez. 2-1 to the Reds, but it's going to be stressful. Stressful. The mighty Reds, and it's not the Arsenal.
Right. Stressful indeed. A huge thank you to Sam Walker-Dine. Matt Jones from The Blue Room, a fantastic new Everton website, well worth checking out, The Blue Room, from Paul Tahaney and from Rob Gutman. This has been the first 50-50 football. The only way this works is if you tell your friends. This is us talking, covering the whole Premier League, looking at as many different sides as we can. We brought it the other side of the Anfield app's paywall in order to be able to spread it right the way across the country, because we think these people are fun and have interesting, nice things to say about football. Tell people to come and get involved with us. See you soon.